Strax kommer veckans avsnitt av Formel 1-podden som den här veckan görs i samarbete med Bertasoni. Bertasoni är det italienska familjeägda företaget som gör hushållsprodukter. Kylskåp, spisar, fina grejer till köket helt enkelt. Och som hjälper dig att laga mat på ett vackert sätt. Vill du se hur de här produkterna ser ut så går du in på bertasoni.se. Bertasoni.se är alltså adressen om du vill spana in snygga grejer till just ditt kök. Nu, dags för veckans avsnitt av Formel 1-podden. Varmt välkomna då till Viasat Motors Formel 1-podd som fortsätter i dessa coronatider att försöka i alla fall leverera senaste nytt ifrån Formel 1-världen. Och faktum är att den här gången, den här tisdagen har vi lite tur, för igår kom det stora nyheter från Formel 1, eller nyheter och nyheter, men det kom i alla fall lite besked ifrån Formel 1. Vi ska nämligen prata kalendern, känner ni igen det? Vi har gjort det i stort sett varje avsnitt nu den senaste tiden, pratat kalender. Hur ser kalendern ut när startar Formel 1 och så vidare. Igår fick vi lite tydligare besked kring detta. Vi ska även prata om Lando Norris. Lando Norris som blev inbjuden att köra IndyCars race på Kota i deras iRacing Challenge. Och det gick ju så där för IndyCar-förarna, för Lando Norris sopade banan med hela gänget. Hur smart var den inbjudan egentligen? Det ska vi tycka till om. Och sen blir det lite annat också. Vi kanske pratar Sebastian Vettels situation och lite sådana saker. Och varför ska vi göra det igen då? Jo, för vi har en lite speciell gäst idag, Erik Stenborg.
Det har vi. Vid namn Scott Mitchell. Han har varit med en eller två gånger tidigare. Ni kan ha sett honom i F1-depån live. Har ni någonsin gått in på therace.com, då har ni läst många av hans förträffliga artiklar. Och på din blogg. Han är överallt.
Han är överallt. Och en framförallt väldigt kunnig journalist när det gäller framförallt Formel 1. Och därför så är det dags att sätta på sig det engelska filtret där hemma om man lyssnar. Det är dags att hänga med på engelska, för det kommer att bli det resten av den här podden. Welcome to the podcast, Scott Mitchell.
Thank you very much. I think it's probably better that we stick to English, otherwise I make even less sense in Swedish than I do in English. So
we just praised your knowledge and everything, so you make a lot of sense, I guess.
Men Janne, vi kan ju snacka lite svenska ibland bara så att han inte hänger med riktigt. Kolla
exakt,
bort
exakt, lite. Exakt. Yeah. We make him sort of confused.
Yes.
I think if you are talking up my knowledge and intelligence, there needs to be a disclaimer at the start of this podcast that just lists it as fake news.
okay.
But it's good to be on the podcast with Eric, because obviously fans of the podcast will be aware of the minor internet feud that developed after my appearance during preseason testing. Yeah. Tempers flared, but we've made up, so it's good to be here as teammates.
We really haven't made up. It was all like, we haven't really talked about it. But
that's how I deal with stuff.
Yeah, I just let it go. Too.
So we have sort of an issue here.
We did, but now I kind of cooled down since then.
Good, yeah, good. Let's be serious then for the next hour or so regarding this podcast. And Scott, to begin with, we got sort of a plan for Formula One to get restarted yesterday. We got a statement from Chase Carey, but that was coming after the fact that Silverstone and the British and the French Grand Prix were cancelled. First cancelled, and then the British Grand Prix was on again, but behind locked doors.
Yeah, so it was we've had a little bit of silence from Formula One for a couple of weeks now regarding the calendar, and then all of a sudden a trio of quick fire announcements in the morning. The French Grand Prix being cancelled was expected, because much like a lot of places in Europe, they've got very strict restrictions, including events with major audiences or major events as they're classified over there, and the French Grand Prix falls within the ban, so that was never going to happen. It's interesting because there seems to be slightly mixed messages from Paul Ricard, because it seemed to be completely ruled out as an option for this year. Eric Boullier is talking about attention already turned into 2021. It's impossible to hold the event. But then there are one or two suggestions that actually all they're saying is it's impossible to hold the event on that date. And as we'll come to, F1 has this plan to race in Europe in July and August. Maybe France could go there, but maybe it wouldn't be called the French Grand Prix. So I don't really know how that would work. My guess would be that Paul Ricard doesn't want to host a race unless it can have fans there. So it can't be the French Grand Prix, because that would have to take place behind closed doors. Maybe they can host something later. But that's a bit confusing. And then Silverstone, with the restrictions that are in place in Britain and the amount of lead time that Silverstone needs to put everything in place, it's a massively, massively popular and well-attended event. So they've just decided, in conjunction with Formula One, based on what's going on in the UK, that they can't do what they need to do now to put the infrastructure in place to have fans at the British Grand Prix. But that doesn't mean that the British Grand Prix won't happen. It could still happen, but it would have to happen without fans, which would be slightly weird, considering that was, for the last 2 years running, has been voted the fans' favourite event of the season.
Yeah, it would be. But still, I mean, just on that note, it's not a... Of course, you get the feeling of fans in the stands when you watch a race on TV, but it's not essential. I mean, a quiet football stadium is worse in that respect, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree, because when you're in a confined space, the spectators add a lot more to the atmosphere, because the noise reverberates. It's like being in an amphitheatre. At racetracks, it's a little bit different. Silverstone is one of those tracks that works. There are certain places around the track which are really good for it, especially when you've got a... Silverstone's very lucky that they've got a six-time Formula One world champion racing in those Grand Prix and winning, because they do go mental. It's become a little bit like the Tifosi at Monza, but just obviously not quite to the same extreme. So it will be slightly odd. I think... They've outlined, what is it, July 5th, the date for the Austrian Grand Prix, which was already in the original schedule. So they're sticking with that as the starting point. So if we had, my understanding is, two races at the Red Bull Ring, 1 week apart, and then potentially two races at Silverstone as well, also 1 week apart, but none of them with fans. So it would be a very unusual way to start the season, but I think it would be responsible.
Yeah, but then just to take what Chase Carey said in that statement, what we can take from that is that there will be, like, they're increasingly, how did he say it? Was increasingly confident,
yes,
that they would be able to start their season in 3rd to 5th of July in Austria. And then, as you said, two races in Austria, then two races potentially in Britain, and then more races in Europe, and then moving to the Eurasia, and which tracks are included there? In, like, this is now we're talking September, October, right?
Yeah, it's difficult to know exactly which combination that they'll go for, but the way I see that there is, my expectation is we'll have two of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Singapore. I don't see, based on the calendar that they want to put together, I just don't see how you can still fit all three of them, because the Asian leg is going to be more condensed because they want to try and get China and Vietnam in there. So something has to give, and Singapore is a city race, a street race, so that's really difficult for them to move their date. I am not an expert in Russia, So I couldn't tell you how they're handling this virus situation, but I would imagine based on finances and logistics, I mean, Singapore and Azerbaijan feel quite sensible from a financial point of view because it would be good for F1, but Russia and Azerbaijan feels a little bit more sensible from a logistical point of view, but it's difficult to say.
And a street track, I mean, that's what we have always discussed, Janne, that it will be more difficult to first of all, to plan it, because it's the track actually needs to be built. And if they're going to start building a track, they really need to know that the race is actually going to happen, because they didn't want to build a track for a few months and then just disassemble it again without being raced on. And also, if we're talking about the audience, like racing without an audience, that's hard to do in a street race. So this is just the gut reaction I get from hearing that they're still planning to or hoping to get street tracks on there or city tracks. It seems more difficult.
But if they get clearance to hold the race in Singapore with enough time before the race is supposed to be held, then it's no problem to facilitate the track itself. So that shouldn't be a problem. The problem is when the deadline is for the Singapore Grand Prix to start the preparation for it. And out of those three, two of them are street races, both the one in Baku and the one in Singapore.
Yeah.
But, it needs to be sorted out if it's possible to hold the race or not quite soon, I guess.
Exactly, and I think that's the problem with it, because there's still no vaccine, there's still no... I mean, who knows what will happen, like a second or third wave of the virus comes through Singapore for some reason.
But,
and then,
but all this is the government itself needs to decide if they're going to open or not. And I guess time will tell, because when we talk about second and third waves and stuff like that, what will happen with the virus, nobody knows at this point.
Exactly.
So,
that's the point.
Yeah, it makes a lot of question marks for the whole calendar, I think. But Scott, when do they need to have a proper calendar together, which they can present? Because when they do, they need to be certain they can run it through, right?
Yeah, so Kerry talks about having a calendar as soon as possible. My feeling is that they need to have something sorted by the middle of May, because that ties in with some of the internal timelines that some major European governments are working to. And it also means that the teams are going to have enough time to prepare, because we've got this line in the sand now, July the 5th in Austria, but that means the teams need to be out there by the end of June, or travelling out there at the end of June. But they're all in shutdown, at the moment, because we've had, among the various measures that have been taken, this summer shutdown that normally lasts 14 days in August has been brought forward, and I think it's 2 months worth of days now, consecutive days of shutdown across March, April and May. So some of the teams started earlier than others, but you will have the latest teams will be in shutdown until the very end of May or the first week of June. So they need 4 to 5 weeks. That's what we're told. That's what a couple of team bosses have told me. They need 4 to 5 weeks to build up to a start date. So if we work back from July the 5th, that takes us to the end of May. That's just to start everything in the factories and get everything ready. So you need to give the teams at least a week or two's notice so that they know what they're doing. The relevant authorities in Austria and the local authorities around Spielberg, they'll need to make sure that the infrastructure is in place, that if the teams are going to be staying there for 2 weeks instead of a week, you need to make sure that there's enough hotels or guest houses or farmhouses to convert. So they don't have a lot of time. I think within the next 2 or 3 weeks, we will need to see something more concrete, because you can't start this season until you know exactly what it's going to comprise. So it's not just this is okay as a line in the sand, as a starting point, put in a date on Austria and then a rough calendar for how the season plays out. That's fine now. But in 2 or 3 weeks, we need to know exactly how this season's going to start, if it's going to start in July.
And how likely is it that we get the decision within 2 or 3 weeks?
I think based on, I know it's different from country to country, but if you look at the fact that Austria is in a good position with the way they're combating this virus and the way they're starting to plan an ease of restrictions. If you look at major things like the Premier League, the football league in England, there are serious plans now ramping up to get teams back into training. And then like Formula One, the Premier League and other sports in the UK want to resume behind closed doors. So I think there is genuine momentum at the moment to work out how sport can return behind closed doors. And I think that is why there is increasing confidence within the F1 organization. And I think by the time we get to the middle of May, I think the situation will also be clearer. There will be more information available. We won't be at a position, as Eric said, where there's a vaccine or anything like that. But I am cautiously optimistic that by the middle of May, we will be in a position to be at least more informed and be able to work out what is the most sensible and responsible thing to do.
Do you know under what conditions the teams need to prepare to be able to do this without an audience in place? They need sort of a contained environment for the teams and all the volunteers that work around the track and all that.
Well, I think you'd need, I know Helmut Marko has talked about having testing procedures in place so that team members would need to make sure that they're clear of the virus, have either tested positive for it and have since recovered, or they don't have it. And then I think once you're in the area, I think you have to observe quite strict isolation practices so that you don't needlessly go to different parts of the country or different towns. But Chase Carey has been quite clear about this. He said that there's still a lot of issues that they need to work out. Not just the procedures that the teams and the various partners need to get into a country, but also how they need to operate once they're there.
And I guess that as long as that they don't allow any attendance to the races, no media, no nothing, no sort of unnecessary people will be allowed to attend the races as well. It's only the absolute necessary amount of people.
Yeah, it's they need to do it on the bare minimum. If you compare Formula One to other sports, which is obviously often a very dangerous exercise, but if you look at football, you could have in theory the teams, the coaching staff, the medical staff, the officials, and the relevant people to run the stadium, and I would imagine you could host a professional football match with what, fewer than a couple of hundred people. In Formula One, you need literally hundreds, and I think you would struggle to do a Formula One event with fewer than 1,000 people. So it is very tricky, and that's why the logistics around F1 getting started again are actually a lot tougher than perhaps a sport like football or rugby or cricket.
Yeah, and it will be very 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 sensitive too, I think, because what happens if a marshal is tested positive all of a sudden, like a local guy coming to do flags at the race, and he has had contact with 15 people. All of a sudden, they're 15 people short of track marshalling, which will...
Yeah, but they will probably attend under the same conditions as the rest of the Formula One paddock.
Yeah, but if something happens, that it's very, very sensitive if they start...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's the same with the Premier League. It was I talked to a colleague that I think they're planning to start in June, I think. And there's like a question of Roy Hodgson. Yeah, okay. I'm not very knowledgeable of football, but it's not that type of podcast anyways. But he's like over 80, and there's a question of him being a risk group. And so would he be allowed to even coaching his team? You know what I mean? So that's like it, everything is so complex in this at this point, which is
One thing that I'm curious about, what you have heard around Scott, is that the fact that Dr. Marco is going out in media in Austria and saying that the race is on for the 5th of July. Is it on or is it not on yet? I mean, there is nothing official from Formula One yet, but I guess that Helmut Marko has had a lot of talks with the government or the authorities in Austria about this, and probably knows more than anyone.
I think Formula One has to play it as responsibly as possible. So outlining July 5th as the provisional start date makes it very clear that that is what they are working towards. But the public messaging around it will obviously be softer because they don't want it to be seen as Formula One's just going to crack on and get back on with it when there are still thousands of hundreds and thousands of people dying all over Europe and around the world. So F1 doesn't want to look callous, whereas the people within, my understanding is that the people within the teams are working on the basis that the season starts in Austria on July 5th. And Marco's Marco, isn't he? He is a law unto himself. He doesn't abide by Red Bull's own rules and restrictions. So even if Formula One explicitly told him, do not tell anyone that the season is going to start in Austria, Helmut would go to the Austrian newspaper or radio station the next day and say exactly that.
Yeah. Which he probably did, though.
So another thing I'm curious about, do you think, because it's all speculation from all of us, because we are no experts, not even Scott, do you think that authorities in the respective countries would give special permission for a contained Formula One environment to come anyway, although the rest of the country is still under lockdown?
I guess it could happen if a country is desperate to have a Formula One race for whatever reason. I guess they certainly could. Whether it will or not, I don't think it can, because the governments have a responsibility to everyone there, and you're talking about millions of people whose lives are being impacted, hundreds and in well most cases thousands of people have died, and hundreds of people are dying every day. To then let a travelling circus for a sport come into the country and flout all of the rules that you set out for these people, to me, would be willfully irresponsible. So I think it relies entirely on governments relaxing wider measures and not making an exception. But I'd be interested to know what the pair of you think about this, because I think F1 cannot underplay the significance of the public perception of whether it's acceptable to go racing or not. I think it could be a disaster if people think that this is an outrage. And I've seen, as someone who is still relatively an outsider in this country, I have seen how much Sweden's attitude towards the virus and the measures in place here have split people. And it's been a controversy. And that's just related to government measures. If Sweden then turned around and said, and now we're going to invite loads of other people in, I can imagine people being up in arms, but it'd be interesting to know what you think.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that's the biggest problem here, that it's the risk is almost higher than the reward going just a tiny bit too early. Because if something would happen, then it could really jeopardize, I would think it would really jeopardize Formula One as a sport, as a whole. If there would be some sort of outbreak in Austria. With that said, I really hope that they do start the season and they have good grounds to be able to do it, of course, because I'm starting to get sick of not seeing race cars.
Yeah, well, that's the problem for for guys like us, because we look at our own situation. That would improve a lot if the racing would start again. But you need to see the bigger picture, of course, and that's what you two are discussing now. And another thing which is interesting is why do they choose July 5th? Is it because they need to squeeze in the 15 races to to uphold the contracts with the broadcasters, or why are they necessarily doing it on the 5th of July? Couldn't they wait until the 1st of September?
I think it's because if you look at it from a point, we don't want to be opportunistic at a time like this, because as Eric said, the risk, if you act opportunistically, the risk outweighs the rewards. But with every government and every major sport looking at June and July as a time where it would start to be responsible to seriously re-engage in competition, that becomes a sort of initial starting point. So then you say, okay, if June or July is a sensible time to start as a generic starting point, is that workable within our calendar? And actually, after this run of races that just are not possible at the moment, you can't have something at Zandvoort because Holland has banned events. You couldn't do Monaco because it's a street race and they weren't able to prepare for the race in time. Spain's got all sorts of restrictions. Canada won't let anyone into the country. Azerbaijan is a street race. France has bans on events. You have these run of races that are just, they are just impossible. But then you get to Austria, which is in, first of all, it's the country that is arguably the best placed in all of Europe at the moment in terms of how they've handled it and where they are in a position to reopen to a degree of normality. The circuit is in quite a remote location as well, and it is relatively well stocked around it, so you would be able to house people there without having to worry about mingling in city centres. Red Bull own the circuit, so they can make the circuit available whenever. There's also, Helmut Marko's got hotels in Graz and stuff like that, so if he needs to pull in a few favours to house people, I'm sure he could. And then in Silverstone, we know that in the UK, the government is very, very keen to help facilitate the return of sport behind closed doors. Silverstone, again, is a ready-made facility. It's got a nice infrastructure around the circuit with hotels and guest houses and stuff, so you could house teams there for a couple of weeks as well. So you actually have this scenario of we go weeks and months of races simply being impossible, and then actually, bang at the start of July, you have two races in a row, 2 weeks apart, per the current schedule, that could actually realistically not only be in a position to host races, but they can also host races however Formula One needs them to be hosted. So it creates this opportunity, and as long as it's responsible to take advantage of that, I think that is why F1 can do this, because then you can get to the end of July and you've already got four races under your belt, and that magic number of 15 or 16 races to get broadcaster revenue suddenly becomes a lot more achievable without having to run into January next year.
And one thing that seems to make Formula One look very serious about starting is that they made some stuff to bring the liquidity in the company up. They arranged for $1 billion to be available. And some of the money has gone to some of the teams in advance payments for money that they should see later on, but they get it now to basically survive. It seems like they are really, really preparing to start the season. It's not just something they say to make the sponsors happy or just a statement in the air, sort of. What are your opinion?
Well, I listened to an hour of Liberty Media investor call last week. That's my lockdown. I love it. That's so much fun.
Yeah, sounds great.
But the investor call, it was quite interesting, because normally these investors calls, okay, it's a bit different with Liberty because F1 is a core business within the group, but F1 is often very rarely mentioned. There are very few F1 questions in these calls because people are more interested in the other big money earners, and F1 doesn't really make a big profit. There were loads of questions about F1 from investors. You know, how are you going to do this? Where are you going to be spending money, giving money to teams to bail them out and stuff like this? So it was quite interesting to hear what Liberty had to say about that. And what it seems to me, based on everything that I've been told, everything I've read and listened to and interpreted, I feel like F1 is putting its best foot forward to be able to navigate this, because this is a crisis and it is an extraordinary set of circumstances. And to make $1.5 billion in cash, basically, available to the Formula One group to be able to do what they need to ride this out, whether that is to fill the gap in broadcaster revenue or sponsorship or race hosting fees, to pay teams advance payments so they don't go bankrupt, to allow promoters not to pay a $10 million hosting fee or $20 million hosting fee because you have to run it without fans. And otherwise, that promoter goes bankrupt and next year you won't have a Grand Prix. So in Australia in particular, I was really critical of F1. I thought that the way it was handled at the start of the season was really bad. But I have to say, a lot of their action over the last few weeks, pretty much since they had their backsides kicked in Melbourne, I think they've actually been quite responsible, and they have a duty of care not only to the participants in Formula One, but to the wider world that engages in Formula One. And I do genuinely believe they are trying to act in everyone's best interest. But ultimately, if we don't get this season started, it does have serious consequences for the sport, for teams, for people, for thousands of jobs further down the line. So they are balancing this horrifically thin tightrope, but they've also got loads of ballast trying to unsettle them as well. So it's a horrible situation for them to be in, and I think they are trying to go about it in the best way.
Okay. when we talked about the calendar earlier, you mentioned that we go into Eurasia, where we suppose the Sochi and Baku and Singapore is part of, but then we have the Asia part, which is of course Japan, but also Vietnam and China. They're trying to fit Vietnam and China in somewhere within this time frame. I'm looking at the weather situation. I don't really know how the weather is in Vietnam in October, but I guess there is a reason they want to hold the race in April. So, I mean, how do you see, for instance, Vietnam being held?
It's a very good question. I think it depends. I think with Vietnam, I think there are two options. I think if Europe is in a position where it can't host races in... I think if Europe is in a position where it can't host races in July and August, which is possible, ultimately, if restrictions don't get lifted or reduced, then I think August suddenly becomes an option to try and fit in something like Vietnam and maybe even China. So I think Vietnam may be in August, but I think the fact that they've laid out Asia as being in October suggests to me that they would look to fit it in around China and Japan, because you want to try and commit it region to region. I suppose there could potentially be a third option, depending on this. This is why it's so complicated for them. There is this run of races in the Americas. I can't see Canada happening, because by the time we get to the Americas, we're well into the winter in Montreal. So if you look at the US, Mexico and Brazil, US and Mexico are already back to back. Then there's a week off. Then there's Brazil. Then there's a week off. Then there's Abu Dhabi. But we know that Abu Dhabi is going back a week later, and Bahrain's going to fit in before Abu Dhabi. So Brazil could potentially fall by the wayside, and then Vietnam goes in there. But that would mean F1 going from Asia to the Americas, back to Asia, and then to the Middle East. So it depends how desperate they are. If they need Vietnam, or they really want it because it's a paying race and it's a liberty race as well, maybe they will bend over backwards to facilitate it. But it's really complicated, and exactly how it fits in is really hard to work out.
So should we come to some sort of conclusion here? Are we going to have a Formula One season in 2020 or not?
Let's do a vote.
Let's do a vote. Yeah. No, but give us a percentage chance. Start with you, Eric.
Yeah, that it will be a season, I think it's a really good chance. like a 90% chance this is Ooh. From the hip.
That's a high, that's a Swedish. High number, yeah.
Yeah, but that we'll have it. But I feel it's I can't let go of the thought of potentially Formula One being the first one to take that step. I mean, we were in Australia, as you said, Scott, and we were in St. Pete, ready to get the IndyCar season going. But then, just taking the IndyCar example, they were supposed to race. They had practice going for the support series.
Same but story then, in Australia.
Yeah, but then everyone else started to canceling, like NHL, NBA, all the other sports series started to cancel their seasons, and then that made it impossible. I mean, they could have run that race, I think. They were about to, but then when everyone else started doing their stuff, they couldn't, you know, keep going. And I think that's the biggest problem here, to be potentially the first major sports event taking place. I mean, Bundesliga in football are about to get going in May, they say, and Premier League in June, so they might not be the first, but considering the complexities of Formula One, it's going to be interesting to see if they are able to take that step, just as a, you know, it's a big step saying that they're actually going through with it.
Especially as it's a global championship as well.
Exactly.
It's more than just going back competing domestically, isn't it? And
yeah,
that's the complication. I mean, I actually agree with Eric's number for a season happening. I'd be 90% sure that a season will happen, but the percentage rapidly decreases when it comes to confidence over how many races it will be.
So but 90, so the number 90 for how many races, Eric? 10? Difficult yes. questions here.
Yes. I'll say 10, but don't 10. Hold me okay. to it.
No, but and you, Scott?
I think they've targeted 15 to 18. That is so high. I can't see that happening. I think there is more than half a chance of getting 15 in. I think 15 is doable. I'm willing to be the absurdly optimistic one with this answer.
So 90% and 15 races.
Yeah.
Okay,
let's be optimistic.
Fair enough. Okay.
You're trying to dodge it.
Yeah. No. Well, I stick to 90 as well. I think there is a good chance of having a season, but I think that 90% is with Eric's number, like 10, 11, 12 races. And as you said, Scott, the percentage will decrease with the number of races they want to do. So I say it's less than 50% chance of having 15 to 18 races, I would say. But if we can have a season of 10 races, which means we can have a world champion, then I'm happy. Whatever happens with Formula One and their agreements with the broadcasters and all that, that's not my... I don't care about that. I just want to see some sort of season going on and to be able to crown a champion. That would be nice, I think, from a very, very difficult year. And if they can achieve that, they have done a splendid job just making that happen, all things considered.
Especially if they can avoid running into January next year. I think it's a big achievement for them to put together, whether it's 10 races, 12 races or 15 races. If you just get to the end of 2020, a season is done. You don't put the teams in a really difficult position at the start of 2021 before a new season begins. I think as long as it's done responsibly, I think that will be a big achievement. If it's done irresponsibly and they dismiss concerns and stuff like this, that would be a very awkward and difficult thing to be part of.
That's a very, very important point, I think, because if they can do this in a way that we trust Formula One, that they do this in a proper way, not rushing into things, needing to cancel in the last minute or stuff like that, then they will come out of this in a good way, I think, even though they don't achieve the goal of 15 to 18 races. Okej, ni lyssnar på Viasat Motors Formel 1-podd. Janne Blomqvist, Erik Stenborg. Idag gästad av Scott Mitchell. Vi har pratat jättelänge nu om det här som är en plan i alla fall för en kalender för 2020. Något som en del misstror väldigt mycket, andra hoppas väldigt mycket på. Och är man någonstans mitt emellan så tror jag man är hyfsat nära sanning i alla fall. Jag tänkte vi släpper kalendern nu, Erik, och börjar prata lite simracing igen nu. För du har lite issues med en sak, nämligen det faktum att IndyCar bjöd in Lando Norris till det senaste iRacing Challenge-racet på Circuit of the Americas. And just to invite Scott into the discussion as well, Eric has some issues with Lando being invited to the IndyCar iRacing Challenge race at COTA, where he won immediately. So Eric, get right onto it.
Yes, let me really tear be this angry. Shit up. Yeah, I'm gonna be super angry. I've already been the bad cop in this show, I feel. So yeah, well, I'm the negative one this week.
Stick to it. Stick to it.
Yeah. No, but the thing is that, as most of you listening to this probably know, was that Lando Norris participated in the iRacing Challenge of IndyCar with McLaren. At the Circuit of the Americas on Saturday, and he won the race. I think he topped every practice session pretty much, and he qualified on pole. He had a spin and won anyways, and I've noticed that people are taking that result maybe a bit too serious in terms of talent of drivers in IndyCar. I mean, this is not like professional journalists or, other drivers saying that IndyCar drivers are bad because they couldn't keep up with Norris in an iRacing race. But still, it's what IndyCar is trying to do at this point is to build up the series. It's gaining interests. They're trying to build up the talent pool, which is, in my view, very high, and they're doing better. I mean, in the last 2-3 years, they've really gained some traction in terms of interest. And what they did is they invited, arguably, I mean, you could say that Lando Norris is certainly among the real race car drivers. He's top five in the world probably in iRacing, and they invited him competing to their stars. With their drivers, most of them have raced in iRacing for maybe 4, 5, 6 weeks, and Norris, I read somewhere that he's been on iRacing since he was 6 years old, which makes it hard for anyone to keep up with him because it's
sort of an uneven
thing.
Contest. Yeah,
and they just opened the door for criticism here. That's okay. My point of view.
So, Scott, what's your take on this?
I understand Eric's point. Actually, I think the value that someone like Lando brings is that he has a profile What comes with that experience of racing online and the presence that he has online is he has a profile like no other. I've followed quite a bit of the F1 drivers sharing their stuff on Twitch, streaming F1 races or other exploits, I particularly enjoyed following Max Verstappen when him and Lando did the Team Redline Pro Driver Series online in different cars, and Verstappen won that, and I watched every race practice, not all the practice obviously, but I watched every qualifying and every race from Verstappen's onboard. I haven't got around to writing it yet, but it's to do a piece on basically like looking at how he drives and that sort of thing. And no one has a profile like Norris. The number of people that follow his live streams and stuff like this, the audience that he brings to something is colossal. So the argument, I think, would be that at a time like this, when it's easier for there to be crossover between series. Lando brings an audience to IndyCar that IndyCar simply wouldn't otherwise had. The problem with that is it's not a legitimate crossover. So if Lando went and did a real world IndyCar race, he wouldn't boss every practice qualifying and race. Look at how hard Alonso found it, even when he had, you know, forget the disastrous attempt to qualify for Indy. When he went there, when the McLaren car was run by a proper IndyCar team, he was there or thereabouts, but he wasn't dominating. And it's not the same as even when Verstappen did the supercars races. You know, Verstappen was at least in the mix. He was in the middle of it. He was battling with established guys, and that was really good because then a driver can go away and say, oh, I had this amazing fight with Max Verstappen, arguably the best driver in Formula One. If you're playing devil's advocate, which Eric has graciously adopted the position
yes,
of,
yes.
What have the IndyCar guys got to show for last weekend? Something that they are dedicating their entire career to. They've just been completely shown up by someone who's come in to do it for a laugh, basically. That is the worst case scenario. The flip side to that is, if you looked at how Lando prepared for it, he got his F1 engineer in to do proper debriefs from testing. He did it really seriously the whole way through. So you can look at it one of two ways, but it is fair of Eric to flag this because it would be wrong and it would be quite ignorant to look at it as a universally positive thing. There are always pros and cons to stuff like this.
And we come back to the discussion we have had, Eric, you and me, about how shall we look at the sim racing in general?
Exactly.
How should we attack the whole sim racing thing? How should we validate it? What is it? How good are you when you're good at sim racing or whatever? It is an isolated thing. You are good at sim racing, fine, but it's not the same thing as racing in real life. So I mean,
I think actually, that's the problem. Because people have a hard time. It's what I said a few weeks ago in this podcast. I think that it's hard to figure out even within yourself whether it's fun to look at the iRacing challenge in IndyCar and seeing that everyone is taking it very serious. I think that's a good thing, of course. But then all of a sudden I just get a flash in my brain saying that this isn't real. This doesn't mean anything, you know? So I have a hard time, you know, figuring out what to make of iRacing. I mean, it's good that it's there. Since we don't have anything else right now, and I enjoy it. I watch all the IndyCar races, and I watch the Formula One races, of course, even though they're very different from each other. But it doesn't hold any ground in my mind in real life. I mean, I actually spoke to Marcus Ericsson yesterday evening, and we spoke a little bit about this, and he said it was actually very positive for him to do this. First of all, to kill some time, but also he's new in Ganassi, and he said it was he's working with this engineer, his spotter, and everything, and he said that it will only help him once they get going on track, because they've learned to pretty much to speak to each other during a racing situation, which is a good thing. But then I can't, coming back to the original thought here is that it's hard to see that I think it was more cons than pros to have one of the best sim racers in the world as a guest driver with IndyCar, I think.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't hold ground in real life.
Would have been better to invite someone else, like Kimi or...
Yeah, or Scott Mitchell. He's a professional driver too.
He's definitely a professional driver nowadays. So, but listen, it's interesting with this sim racing stuff. If we leave the fact that Lando was doing a very good job in the IndyCar race, it was good fun seeing him, I think. And he made Felix Rosenqvist drive, what did he write, 170% of his skill?
I think it was 178, actually.
Say 178, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was good fun. For myself, I tend to look at it as entertainment. That's it. I don't put any other values into these kind of races. It's good fun if the Swedes are doing a good job in the races, but it's not the real thing. But it's good fun. That's my take on it. But coming back to the sim racing, you work for the race. You are arranging a lot of sim racing. These legend races are super fun to watch, and we see Jan Magnussen and Jensen Button battling out, and we see Jacques Villeneuve racing with a hand control from an Xbox or whatever, and stuff like that. It seems like it's blown up there, this sim racing stuff, and you show a lot of things on your website.
Yeah, so one esports was one of the sort of main pillars of what the race is trying to achieve. It isn't just another conventional racing website, and part of that is because esports around different disciplines, not just racing, but all sorts of gaming, it has become a serious industry, and it doesn't always get it's perfectly fine to look at it and think this is just a bit of fun or this doesn't hold any bearing on reality. You know, you're not going to go out and judge a racing driver in reality because of what they do in online racing, are you? So that's
not
the point.
But people sometimes do, which is
some people do. Yeah. But the point that we've tried to make is that the esports has developed into an industry that, and racing has caught up with that industry now to the point where it deserves to have an authentic level of coverage so that people can see what it's about. So that's what we've tried to do. And when there was the opportunity to fill the void left by real world racing being put on hiatus, I was really impressed over the Australian Grand Prix weekend, how quickly it was all mobilized. And it's been really cool to see how it's been taken up, and it's good to see that other series have launched their own official stuff. But one of the things that I found very interesting from it is, it sort of goes back to what you were saying there, it's the skills transfer from the sim to reality. That's definitely the case. If you're good, Marcus Ericsson said this to me actually a couple of weeks ago when we spoke. If you're good on the sim, you could do a good job in reality. You wouldn't be as good, but you could still do a good job. But it's actually harder to go from reality to the sim because you lose inputs. You lose that seat of the pants feel that you get in the car. You don't have the movement around you. You don't have the 360 degrees of movement and noise and everything. It's a very sense driven business driving a racing car quickly, and you also you have the reality of what happens if you run wide and stuff like this. So when you take away a lot of those inputs, it becomes harder. Whereas if you start from a sim point of view, you're working with what you've got. You don't have to unlearn stuff. So you just have to find this happy medium. And that's why it's been interesting to see how the best of the racing drivers. So this is the thing that the race have done, which I think, along with the Legends Trophy, these are the two things that have stood out for me. One is the integration of the sim drivers, the professional esports guys, in with real world drivers, because then you see just how good they are. But it's also interesting to see just how good some of the pro drivers are. You see Stoffel Vandoorne going up against the absolute best of the best of the esports world, and he's finishing fourth or fifth, which is a pretty good achievement for someone who never made a massive splash in Formula One quite the way he was expected to. And then on the Legends Trophy side of it, which is purely for fun, where else, in what other genre or discipline, or how else can you get the field of guys like Magnussen and Button, Franchitti, Villeneuve, etc., etc.? That it's just really cool. So esports serve a few different purposes. I think as long as you don't read too much into it, there is a lot of enjoyment to be had there. But just as long as people don't confuse it with an absolute like-for-like replacement for reality.
Yeah, that's probably very wise, I think.
Exactly. So don't be too angry, Eric. It's not good for you.
I'm not angry. I'm just
you were supposed to be
advocate.
Raging.
Yes, but
listen.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're going to rage, angry you next need to week. Rage.
Yeah, I'll be more angry next week.
Good, good. It's quite funny to see that Eric is going to be our angry guy because it's mainly me who is angry.
Exactly. So. I'm the sensible one.
Yeah, you are. Usually. You are. So coming back to the you are going to debut in a proper sim race, Scott.
Yeah, I did compete in the last round of the races All Star Series as a guest entry, which went relatively okay. First lap in first qualifying, I was faster than Gabby Chavez and James Collado. Which is an indicator of just how unrepresentative sim racing is to reality.
Exactly, that's all we need.
I was 0.4 of a second, I think, slower than Van Dorn, which would just, if you put us in a real racing car, wouldn't happen. But yeah, so tonight, what's today, Tuesday evening, the Grand Prix Virtual World Championship has, I honestly know very little about this. One of your commentating colleagues, Jana, Jack Nichols, who I'm good friends with. He's the BBC's Formula One commentator, and people might know him as the English voice of Formula E. He is of the sim world, and he's racing in this GPVWC series, because they've got lots of different ones. They've got a proper like Formula One style thing. I think they've got a Porsche Super Cup version. And I'm in the entry-level Academy series, which is for Formula 3 cars, not proper Formula 3, unfortunately, the GP3 successor Formula 3, at Poznan Raceway in Poland. So I've been doing a lot of testing. The entry, and this is why I've decided to embrace giving it a shout-out. The entry is phenomenal. It's a full 41-car grid with 9 reserves on the list as well. That's incredible. I've never raced. I did all sorts of karting in the UK, and I worked as a national motorsport reporter for Autosport. There are very, very few classes of racing in real world that get oversubscribed, and that is one of the other cool things about esports is these people would probably never get anywhere near a real world racing car. But you've got a well-organized, well-run professional series in proper cars that are actually fairly true to reality, getting an oversubscribed entry. And that, to me, is what esports is all about. Lower the barrier of entry, have a bit of fun, and just don't ruin people's careers by putting them up against an absolute alien of a professional sim racer, which I think was Eric's point earlier.
Yes. Exactly.
So you're competing now in a 10,000-pound rig, yeah?
No, I mean this is a podcast, so you won't be able to see, but you guys will be able to see.
I can tell everyone that's, what it is.
There it's you go.
The same stuff as me.
Yeah, it's the play seat challenge.
Yep.
The foldable play seat that you can have, which is easy to both stow away and to access when you need it. And the wheel is what?
It's a nice cheap. Hang on, let me see if I get it. It's a nice, relatively cheap Logitech G920. So nice and entry level. Nice and entry level, and a grand total of less than £500 for wheel, pedals, and seat. I have now got an actual proper gaming PC just so I can run R Factor and stuff like this. Yeah. But I would say that my entire setup, computer, steering wheel, pedals, and seat, came to less than £1,000, which, when you consider, like, I was speaking to Marcus about this, and you know, like, Felix helped Marcus sort him out, didn't he, with absolute top of the range stuff, and you're talking thousands of pounds here. But yeah, for maybe 10 or 11,000 Swedish crowns, I've got myself the world's cheapest Formula 3 car. So
yeah, but you're still competing, and you're still probably going to do well, being up there with the best of the guys. And as you said, you were just a couple of tenths behind the guy like Stoffel van Dorn. Eric, you have the same placey challenge.
Yes.
You do the Thrustmaster 300.
I think so, yes.
Ferrari edition.
Yes.
Which I have tried.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. You and me, we play with a PS4.
Yeah.
Myself, I have the Fanatec CSL Elite F1 edition, which is the F1 wheel. it's a very good equipment that I use, and I had the Playseat Evolution, which is a step up from your seats. It's a proper seat, and it's more like more rigid thing, but still not as the aluminium rigs that you can see, which cost you like 700 euros or whatever. And it's working really good, and I'm enjoying it so much. And I drive, and I've come to the point where I stop using the assists. So now, I'm not very quick. I thought I was very quick with the assists on, and when took it off, I lost like 5 seconds immediately, and then it took me like 2-3 hours to get even close to what I did with the assists on. So it's clearly a big difference, but I'm enjoying it so much, and I'm enjoying driving the old F1 cars. That's what I enjoy most.
Have you found anywhere that have Swedish tracks? I'm really curious. I would love to find a mod that has Anderstorp or Mantorp or something on there.
Yeah, that's a good question.
It must be, because they did the Porsche Carrera Cup Scandinavia Championship last year. Yeah, so there must be all the tracks there.
Yeah, but what platform was that? I should know because I was there, but I don't remember.
You didn't care back then. It.
Yeah, well, probably not. but still, let's see if someone else, because we have a few listeners who are really into this with sim racing, they could probably solve this for us. And let's hear from you on our Facebook page to see if we can arrange some Swedish tracks for Scott to try out, and even for me and Eric to try out as well. It would be good.
Yeah, that'd be very fun. And then hopefully, if someone can mod a little virtual Yana as well,
yeah, sure,
to be trackside doing the interviews and commentary, that would be quite fun.
That would be good. And that'd Eric really is cool. the demon producer.
I'm not visible anyway, so no need to
doesn't
mod
matter.
Me.
So the question we get is as well, when are we going to race each other, and are we going to prepare a podcast race for our listeners or whatever? I don't know if a lot of people get in touch and say they can help us out, but
But the thing is that we all have different platforms, so
yeah,
we need to do it on PlayStation. So if someone is listening right now, maybe we talked about this, Janne, that we should just do like a time attack thing, and then people can
save our laps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
then we'll I can hire someone good.
Set a good time, as you and Rickard did when we did that feature on the Effort Upon Life. Also, finally, I think we're getting close to the finish, but I want to, speaking of sim racing, we will have one of the participants on Effort Upon Live, via PlaySport Effort Upon Live, som vi kör varje söndag. I helgen kommer vi köra Kinas Grand Prix 2018.
Scott Mitchell. He switched to Swedish now. Yeah.
you don't need to hear this. 15.30 kör vi ju som alltid, och vi kommer ha en stor gäst faktiskt med via Skype. En stor liten gäst som kommer delta i F1s virtuella Grand Prix. Faktiskt är det inte Hollands Grand Prix eller Nederländernas Grand Prix.
Ja, det kanske det är.
Jag tror Nederlands Grand Prix på Interlagos, vilket är lite konstigt. Men,
ja, för Zandvoort finns inte i spelet, nej.
Exakt. Nej. Så att, där är det.
Samma som när man körde Vietnam. Man körde Vietnam i Australien, så blir det Zandvoort fast i Brasilien.
Precis. Han kommer i alla fall vara med, denna onämnde människa.
Du får inte avslöja vem det är, eller?
Nej. Embargo.
Varför?
Embargo. Det är stora grejer här.
Jag vet alltså inte heller. Kan
jo,
vi låtsas?
Hur som helst, kolla på söndag. Det är allt jag försöker säga. Nu måste vi avsluta det här.
And maybe Scott is attending as well, yeah?
Yeah, I already said that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I didn't listen.
No. All right. We're very bad at ending podcasts. Let's just say goodbye.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it very much, you attending the podcast.
No
really
worries.
In-depth knowledge about the calendar.
Thank you.
Alla andra syns om en vecka. Ha det gott. Hej då!